It's Cardamalia, who you have heard about and read about, and she's been visiting since yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought we would try out a. She said, What are we going to talk about?
What are we doing?
And I said, well, we pretend this is a talk show. Marla and I will start talking, and people should feel free to interrupt, and we won't talk for that long before we open it up officially, and then we may get re-involved in conversation again. But I thought I would ask you to go back to about 1980, which from my mental model of your work is before you and Carl really got involved in, computational environments in the school,
mm-hmm.
And beyond the schools. So what were you doing then? How would you describe yourself then? And if you could talk us into, the beginnings of Cecil and maybe, what you did in the 1980s and early 90s before the knowledge form stuff that you folks have read about.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. I mean, that's a fun place to start. We were very much interested in writing, the writing process, like how did people manage to express their ideas, and in particular what fascinated us was the difference between at that time, a lot of people were doing expert-novice studies, so everybody was looking at what's an expert, what's a novice in every field you could imagine. Within writing research, it was very interesting the extent to which we saw the act of writing as it was handled by people who are proficient writers as what we came to call knowledge transformation. So they would take the idea of putting out ideas as the moment to reflect on those ideas, contemplate alternatives to the way they stated that, certainly the seeking of feedback, so that it was a moment to reflect deeply on those ideas. Well, not just a moment. I mean, the numbers of revisions and so forth that people would go through in working with their ideas was really impressive to us.
Were you working with college students primarily then, or younger people?
No, it actually was quite developmental. So we started with just the earliest markings of young students in preschool all the way up to university. So we had thousands and thousands and thousands of texts that we would analyze. And it took so long to have this insight that I'm embarrassed today, but it took a lot of looking at these, and as I say, tens of thousands. What came to really impress us was the extent to which the writer who were much less proficient could actually produce text so much more quickly than people who were good at it, that it was almost the reverse of what the field was saying. Expertise, you could match patterns fast, you could solve problems more quickly, you had to build up all of this repertoire of patterning and quick solutions. And it was like kind of the reverse. No matter what we asked, like, should girls and boys play together on the hockey field? Well, the experts would kind of, I've got to go study this, I've got to figure out this, like, that's a really tough question, whereas the kids would say, yes, they should, because, or no.
What this is reminiscent of, I don't know if you know the early work of Getzels and Csikszentmihalyi,
uh-huh.
on problem finding.
Absolutely.
I don't know if we talked about this in class, but they found that the artists at the Art Institute School in Chicago, these are art students, who would eventually be considered the most creative, were ones who, when they gave them an assignment, namely to draw or paint a still life, would spend a lot of time looking at the objects, move them around, and could essentially invent their own problem. Whereas the ones who were not going to be creative would sort of sit there and do it. So it's basically it's problematizing.
Yeah. And it was really, it took a long time to finally identify what we came to distinguish as the knowledge-telling strategy, which was people, for the most part, when they're fairly naive in the process of writing, see it as a moment where they're supposed to tell what they know. So it's kind of like bringing forward in their mind what it is they know about about a topic, saying it, and the act is over. Whereas for people who are writing and typically more proficient, it's a moment for transforming their ideas. And so we really came to see the cultures of schools as so much about knowledge telling. I mean, you read an article and you're supposed to say what the article said. You're supposed to study something and say what you learned in the classroom. So we came to see the cultures of school as so consistent with knowledge telling that we started to really wonder, well, how would you ever get to a knowledge transforming model of what it is to work with ideas? So that's where we started.
And what was the first CECL endeavor like?
Oh, it was actually me teaching. I had my first job teaching 350 students. So, I mean, I'd never taught university before, and my first thing was to teach developmental psychology to these students. And I couldn't figure out how to make contact with them. To tell you the truth, like, I was teaching, like, 8 courses, and so one had 350. Everything was a blur to me, you know, and I was thinking, gee, how do I make contact with what they're thinking? I was just, you'd run from class to class and be teaching in these massively large classes. So I started, actually, one of the things I'd ask students to do was write a summary of what happened in the class so that I could get some sense of what it is they were doing. And then I would see these summaries of what I had said, and they were so different from what I believed I had said, and they were so varied, I kept thinking, were they in the same class that I was talking in? I mean, it was just quite a phenomenon for me. I mean, 350 of these varied interpretations of what was going on. So then I could have really wonderful conversations in classrooms by studying these and posing the different conceptions of what had happened. But I had to work so hard at that I began to think, wait a second, the students should be working hard at this. Like, why am I doing all of the work here? So I began to think, well, gee, what would it be like if they could enter their ideas into a medium where they could see each other's ideas and perhaps be fascinated at how many different interpretations there was of exactly the same content that they were all living through, so that if you could have a more public life around the mental activity that goes on in interactive or teaching interactions, then perhaps people could take more agency in interpretive accounts in different theories about what was happening. They themselves could go engage in more of the process that I was engaging in, which of course was back to this kind of thinking, maybe you could touch this knowledge transformation process that came to seem so important, of where you put out an idea and transform it, as opposed to this was what the lecture was about, and that discourse becoming fairly shallow. So the first thing was I just talked to some computer scientists, and I asked them to just do some simple little thing where everybody could enter their ideas into a common forum, and they could see each other's ideas, and they could add comments onto their ideas, and that was the beginning of CECL.
And how did you come to work with younger kids? What was the...
I'm thinking, just a developmentalist deep in my soul. So anything I do, I like to do from very young ages on to...
But in the paper you wrote, you talked about first grade, fourth and sixth or something like that.
Right.
So it actually has been across the age span, or did you start working with one particular age initially?
It's been pretty consistently across the age span. Yeah.
And I guess one of the surprising things is that this is less problematic for young kids than people might have thought.
Well, I actually, one of the things I'd love to hear in this class, you, Kurt, I mean, I've actually gotten, my head's been pretty dramatically turned around, you know. I mean, I grew up with Piagetian stage theory and concrete abstract operations, and so the notion that some young child could generate a theory, that they could literally hear the contrasting models of how different people had theories that didn't fit with theirs, and that they could hold on to those ideas and in fact deepen those ideas over time, just was not the stuff for grade one. And now I think we're seeing it, and we're seeing it time and time again, and I've come to see their ideas. They are objects for them. It's like everybody keeps saying, well, if you want, you need manipulables. You're thinking that their ideas are manipulables. They care dramatically about these ideas. They're not so abstract either when they put them out in some representational form, and then somebody else attaches something to their idea. They oftentimes report, well, they just never knew their ideas were important. I mean, there really isn't much space for ideas to have a life in classrooms. So I actually, my sense is, I would love to hear what you say to this, but I actually think that the reason that we have a lot of the stage models we have is the cultures have been really antagonistic to working with abstract ideas and creating cultures that both prize that and love to see what happens to their ideas. So my sense is that we have, in lots of ways, a developmental psychology built out of cultures that really bias the kind of slant we have on what it is we're able to see.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've met Mara Kuchevsky, who's up there in the back. She works with us on our Reggio Emilia project. But out of the class probably doesn't know much about that. But this is we've been working with schools in northern Italy for the past several years, and they work with even younger kids, kids who are, you know, 3, 4, well, they actually start at 18 months, but we look mostly at the kids who are from 3 to 6. And again, I think existence proofs are what challenge developmental psychologists. You probably know that Jerry Bruner has been spending a month there each year for God knows and how long, and it's because it's also expanded his views of what, you know, what's possible with kids. Talk a bit about World 3, because I think that was an important grounding of your ideas. And it's not something that's familiar to most of the class.
Okay. Karl Popper talks about three worlds of understanding. Like, you can work in World 1, which is you're working with physical objects. And then in World 2, you're working with the representations of those objects. And in World 3, you literally, the object, the abstract object itself, is really fundamental to the kinds of interactions. Like, you can create an object, and to create an object in the World 3 is to create a theory, to create a problem solution. You're not making something with your hands, you are making an idea, and that idea has some space in which it exists and it continues to exist. And it seems to me the history of thought is very much about people putting ideas out there and then finding ways in, I mean, lots of ideas get generated, not lots of ideas continue to live in society. And so what it takes to get an idea to live in society, what it takes to pick it up, what's the constructions around it that give a life an idea, is really what Popper's playing with this. Not playing with, I mean, he was very eloquent in his defense of this notion of these three worlds or three levels of knowing. And the World 3 is the world of these abstract objects.
I mean, I think progressives have always felt that kids could explore and respect ideas. I don't think there was ever any fundamental problem with that. But I think there was really the absence of support, and so the notion was, you know, kids would either figure stuff out on their own, or you had a engineer the environment so they would figure things out, rather than the kind of support you have both with the computational environment and the kinds of labels like Rise Above and things like that, which basically gives them the scaffolding that they need to be dealing fundamentally in the world of ideas. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, actually, people keep saying, why do you build this technology? And I actually ask myself this a lot too. You know, it's expensive, it's hard, the technologies change, you spend most of your resources just catching up with the latest browser or whatever it is. And it's not the mission. The mission is the transformation of education. But, we keep trying to give it up. It's like it's really hard and it's really expensive. But we don't know how to find the space in which ideas could really live. And I've been thinking, well, imagine in our disciplines or our world if somebody took publication away from all of us. So there was no place to get your ideas out there. Well, in schools, there really is no place. I mean, you get things pasted on the board, and then when the board gets crowded, they go off. And then whatever the next thing is, then that's what's on the board. But there's no way for sustained ideas. There's no way for ideas to escape the classroom. I mean, one of the things we're finding that's most powerful is, kids working on worms and trying to figure out how do they make it across the classroom. And then you do a little search in the semantic space, takes you off to scientists and people elsewhere in the world who are studying this, and you get a sense that you're in an enterprise about a cultural heritage, and you belong to that much broader cultural heritage in society. And we simply can't find a way to do it without the technology. And Ann Brown and I started off with, our experiment, Whole Schools for Thought, was about she was going to do it.
Well, I actually wanted you to talk about that, because I think that's one of the most interesting and useful and probably cautionary lesson as well of what happened sort of over the last 10 years. So I'd like to actually have you look at that frontally. But I also, after about 5 minutes, so want to turn it over to the class with a specific mission. A lot of you are educators, you've been teachers in school, and there's been, I think, a fair amount of polite restiveness in the class. We haven't really talked much about classes in schools yet, even though that's part of the promissory note in the title of the class. So I'm interested to know, those of you who've been in schools, and particularly we might say sort of regular vanilla ice cream kind of schools, not laboratory schools connected with Columbia University. To what extent this focus on knowledge construction and transformation with kids really taking the lead is something which, on the one hand, is familiar and yeah, we're doing it, or on the other hand, is God, that is not what schools are about at all, and certainly not in this country, and certainly not once you get out of Scarsdale. So I'd like to hear some people reaching into your own psyches to see how this stuff strikes you. But I'm going to give you my version, which is undoubtedly not correct, but if you can correct it. Is about a dozen years or so, the New York funders, in particularly Mellon and Russell Sage and John Brewer, who's not in New York, but McDonald said, gee, there are these three really interesting technology-based constructivist efforts to improve American education, particularly where it most needs to be improved. There's the Toronto effort of Marlene and Carl Bereiter and their colleagues, the CECL, which became Knowledge Forum, what, half a dozen years ago? There's something called Communities of Learning, Fostering Communities of Learning,
Fostering Communities
which was
of
in
learning.
Oakland, and it was the brainchild of Ann Brown and Joe Campione. And that was, it has to be called a cottage industry. It was very intense working in very few schools, fifth, sixth grade, biology, social studies, trying to get kids to basically undertake projects which would have them learn biological taxonomy, causes of diseases, things like that. And then there was John Bransford work, which is probably known to many of you out of Vanderbilt, out of the Peabody School, which has been leading in particularly in mathematics education, creating the Jasper series, these video discs where you have a kind of a rich video plot with lots of embedded algebraic or kind of proto-algebraic questions, and kids get involved in the story, and then they have to figure out, will Jasper make it back home before the hurricane, things like that. And the idea is, let's give them a lot of money, a lot of play space, and let's have them make a real souffle, on which the rest of the country can rise. So you can correct all the errors, but what happened?
Well, you got a lot of money. but not a lot of money, but we did get enough resources to bring these three projects together. And the idea, you know, is if each one of these are making advances, then put together, if they all belong to a same constructivist pedagogy, then they ought to do three times as well, at least, if you put them all together. So interestingly, they got put together, and it was kind of interesting. They got put together very quickly by some teachers, and so people would manage to take a part of an activity that was found in each program and manage to get all of those working in a classroom. And it was very interesting. I know this mostly because Anne Brown and I talked about it obsessionally, constantly. What was amazing for us is that we could never see in those constructions of how it got put together either our dreams or our real belief about what it is we were trying to accomplish. And so it became, it really became interesting, and I'll now flip out of the Schools for Thought as a whole enterprise to just the conversations that Anne and I used to have so much. What we really knew is deep down in, we were not, even between us, and we were both good friends and respected each other's work immensely, we could not get just the two parts of what we were doing together as deeply as we believed. And in fact, the teachers at each of our sites who had been enculturated in these environments the longest had the most trouble. That is, it became like there was something really different about what we were trying to accomplish. And so this wasn't this easy fit. But at another level, it was like just going very well. Like people could abstract activity structures that felt to us like they were the more superficial dimensions of what people could see, and they could get all of those activity structures going. But what it wasn't really holding on to was the deep level of what we were doing. I've actually only recently come to see that the real problem was that in the deep epistemology of what it is, I think, that we were trying to do. The Schools for Thought itself had many classrooms then using this array of activity structures.
Schools for Thought was the label given to
the amalgamation
enterprise.
So it was doing fine. It was getting positive research results. It moved into schools within where the founding agencies had, where they their home bases. So they all wanted schools in which they were working. So at that level, it was a success. I don't actually ever think that my own sense is the positive data that were created were never any stronger than each of the programs were creating in their own right. Nobody's ever said that much. I don't have much reason to say that. It's just know that I know the date of each of the projects, and I'm not sure it was tripling anything. And I've subsequently really gotten interested in how constructivism has just kind of mushed everything together. It's like, you know, the educational discourse now is either your transmission model or your constructivist, and I think that's taken us about as far as we can go. I mean, I think until we start looking at, well, everybody calls themselves constructivists, but there are still dramatic differences in these constructivist pieces.
Well, everybody who's involved in the academy may use that term, but it's a kiss of death in the society. I mean, that's something we may talk about later. But what's happening in America now, in American public education, as I'm sure you know, is deeply transmission driven.
Oh.
Teaching to tests, getting rid of anything that's open ended. And we can talk about the politics of that. But no, I mean, you would not be welcome in the Senate, I can tell you that. Neither in Massachusetts nor in Washington. Maybe things are different than north of the border.
No, actually, I mean, we've really put an institute together that's an international institute, because so much of, I think, the exciting energy right now is coming out of an international perspective on this. I mean, Japan and Singapore, this amazes me. And like, here's North America in this one space in which getting the curriculum tighter, getting the standards tighter, doing all of this is the way to a new generation. They literally are cutting curriculum out of their guidelines and mandates, and they're saying, wait a second, if there is no space for creativity and reflection, where will it ever take hold? So that seems to me like a dramatic social experiment. I mean, just dramatic.
How about some folks who would like to speak about their own experience and what they thought in reading about KF and also in hearing about it today?
I saw a demonstration of it in a different class or workshop before, and the one thing, I thought it was really amazing because it was it definitely looked like this whole constructivist model actually right there in front of you. But the one thing I was concerned is I saw a representation of the building of a biological model, like figuring out how the eyes work in relation to the brain and sight and everything like that. And the thing that I was nervous about was that if kids were creating theories about things that we have scientific evidence for, there's a chance, likelihood that other kids are going to read theories that someone else put up that have falsities. And there's just, and although you have to keep going back and you have someone who's moderating and changing, there's something about seeing something written in print that I worry that kids made their own idea. So I was wondering how you address that.
Yeah. Well, it's actually interesting. I think it's the most worrisome thing to the most people about it, what we're about, and that is that if you create a space of freedom for people to say what they're thinking about something, and you're working with people who are pretty naive in the field, what you're going to do is get a pool of ideas that are reasonably naive about the content that they're working on. So, from a theoretical point of view, our position, I'll tell you that, and then I'll tell you some of the experiments about what we're trying to do to understand what's happening there. But from a theoretical perspective, I should say the deep level at which I think communities of learners, which is the work that Anne Brown and Joe Campione were doing, and the work that's happening in Vanderbilt, which they talk about anchored instruction. So for them, the deep epistemology that holds together that work is guided instruction. So what you're doing is getting systems aligned so that here's the content that you are trying to get people good at, and you are guiding them towards that point of understanding. So there's much more safety and comfort around that, because it's that the main central thrust of what's happening is that you have either the mentors or the teachers or somebody who's in control of the curriculum and guiding that, or the anchored instruction has these anchored videos that embed the kinds of knowledge that you want to get people to get to. We're really trying to figure out, so how does knowledge innovation happen? Like, obviously there's not somebody guiding you to the innovative idea, because the very thing that makes it innovative is it hasn't been thought of before. So somewhere our science has got to give us some leverage on this notion about how do people create knowledge? And it's a different enterprise, and we've actually started using the term knowledge building instead of learning, saying that this process of learning is very much about taking up the cultural heritage of your society. There's got to be this other thing that explains knowledge creation and knowledge innovation, and that's what knowledge building is about. And if ever I think that I wish Anne was still here to talk about this, but I think finally that is where the tension was in what was happening. So if you can kind of imagine within a structure that says that benchmark lessons were a primary part of what were the part of the community of learners. So you would ever, once those ideas started coming out that, well, actually, the culture wasn't refined to get those ideas out front. It was very much about reading things, but there were these benchmark lessons. For us, there aren't benchmark lessons, although nothing stops anybody from giving a lesson or putting their ideas in or saying, but wait a second, that's not what Galileo thought, or that's not what Newton thought. So where's the pressure for the advances, and do these naive ideas grow? Well, the data we have on this, I'm going to back up one more time. So theoretically, the history of thought says that essentially ideas continually improve, and that's just what the history of thought is about. So that's that process takes place by people come up with counter evidence. They come up with something they've read or heard about that doesn't make sense. Somebody questions, but how does that work if this is it? Or this is a different impression of that, so how does that work? So if you have a culture that is aligned with thinking deeply as opposed to just getting the right answer, the whole press on an idea is to make it advance. And in fact, improvable ideas is all what it's about. That's just what you get accustomed to, you know. Galileo's ideas were improved upon. Newton's ideas have been improved upon. Improvable ideas is it. So if you can get that energy going, then they're going to see different people's ideas. They're not going to defend their idea. They're not, if there's an idea, somebody, you've got 30 people in the most minimal context. You've got a teacher. You've got books. You've got distributed environments. You can let biologists in. You can really align things so that the likelihood that your idea will have a run for its money is just going to happen. And then if you like having your idea have a run for its money, if that's what you're there to do, then you kind of, guess what I discovered? You know, I wasn't right when this happened. I was right when this happened. So our test for ourselves is whether we can get that energy so that what we're seeing is continual improvement of the ideas, that in fact there's not a settling in, so that if you take those naive ideas and study them, do people rally around them? Do they gain hold? The answer is we have no evidence of that happening, and we have a lot of evidence that people go deep into the disciplines. And as a matter of fact, one of our biggest signs, I think, of success is that instead of well, we have to quit doing this because the unit is over, it's kind of like, no, wait a second, we're just getting on to something here. So I think you've expressed the key concern. I think you have to have a deep belief in what's possible and align an entire culture around it. And that's what's so hard, I think, about what we're trying to do.
If I can just interject for a minute, in science, there are mistakes all the time that are taught as truth. Like, adults can't grow new synapses, adults can't grow new neurons. Everybody knew that was true 30 years ago. And now it's blatantly false. So it's not, science doesn't have the truth. It has to deal with errors and corrections all the time, just like these kids do.
Actually, one of the signs that please us immensely, like to say, oh my God, my idea is what they thought in the 18th century. So it's kind of like, you know. And another kind of thing you'll see in the discourse is, one of my favorite is, Newton worked on my idea.
Let's hear some from I would particularly like to hear from people from the school context in this country.
I found it interesting that you said that, like, you know, we teach in units or ideas in schools, and based on my experiences, like, it is that you have to teach a unit and move on, because I was student teaching in Massachusetts, and I was just actually reading an article today how teachers are upset because you can't teach what you want to teach. You have to teach to the test. I mean, that's, if you're teaching a public school in Massachusetts, the MCAS is huge, and that's the reality. And other states also have high-stakes testing. So, the technology idea is great in exploring ideas, but do you have an idea of how a school in Massachusetts could implement it without compromising what they need to the teacher's task, ultimate task, to teach to the test, which I don't necessarily agree with teaching them, but it is reality.
It is reality.
It's what I saw when I was doing teaching.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. We have a couple of experiments going on, and if there's a chance to work with any of you to actually create a more profound experiment, I would love it. But anyhow, here's the idea. One of the things that also keeps students from having much agency about their own minds and where they're going is that, in fact, here's the curriculum, and that's driving what the teacher's doing. So even if you let them work with their ideas some, it happens in such small little units because there's just not enough time that they can never, it can't go deep, it can't get going. So one thing that's always been amazing to me is that they are kept blind to the curriculum. And so for us, it's kind of, well, let's create the views that say what the curriculum is that you're supposed to be accomplishing. So here's where what you're studying, here's the content, here's what the curriculum guidelines are. So that when they're, once they're going, they can link their ideas to those curriculum guidelines. So that the problem really is not, like when this works, we believe that the curriculum itself settles things low, because it creates the middle ground to which everybody is supposed to get, and it meters it out in these 2 to 5. So all of our excitement comes from the fact that kids can outdistance the curriculum, and if they know what the curriculum is, when I say I'd like a more comprehensive demonstration, what we just have is mini demonstrations. Like we have, here's the curriculum, and here's where the students got to, and here what they do is link their ideas, and we give them the tests that they were supposed to perform by, and they do well, and they tend to do, above grade level. But how do you get a major demonstration of that? Like, I think you'd have to have, well, here are the Massachusetts guidelines, and here are kids longitudinally over this. You'll never get it in 2-3 week blocks. You've got to have a more longitudinal perspective.
I think an option, maybe, right now I'm doing some work at Scale Dome on after school time, and I think, like, bridging, we're moving towards, a time where school is connected with after school, so kids aren't just going after school to play games or whatever. There is this curriculum component, and I think it would be interesting to explore that as a way to have a forum for exchange of ideas that you're discussing.
It's enticing. It makes sense. I'll tell you what I think the real problem is. That this has got to be so central to what you're about and doing. This is like a culture, and it is as profound, I think, as the culture of knowledge building is. So it would be like making a scientist just think, okay, I'm going to get to do my real work in these few hours after I work. You just kill the person. And I think it's just that you need you need your teacher to prize, be excited about your advances. I'm just not sure. I've come to think it's 180 degrees off on education. And I've begun to think, we might never actually have a chance to show what's possible, because we might never have a chance to go 180 degrees the other way around. And on the other hand, the reason I'm here is because I think we're dreaming with people who think maybe 180 degrees isn't so hard after all. Who knows?
Something like what you were saying, it seems like it's, like you said, it's like a culture, like this knowledge building. And I'm curious what you think. A lot of times when we develop some kind of innovation or technology, it's tested out on the high school level, where they're already used to, their K-8 education, how they went. But I noticed that a lot, you use it in fourth grade or third, when they're young. Have you tried it with high school, like introducing it to students that were not used to this type of learning, and how did it go?
Yeah, I have to say, the other part that's most encouraging to me about the theoretical underpinnings is that we actually now, we have it going in about 20 countries, so very different cultural contexts, all the way from, I guess the youngest kids are junior kindergarten, and all the way up through university, like hundreds of university courses, and hospitals, medicine. So what we're really saying is, it's not about schooling. It's about how minds and brains work, and how it's about the socio-cultural dynamics of how people advance knowledge. And if we're hitting it right, it shouldn't be limited to schools. It shouldn't be limited to ages. It shouldn't be limited to cultures. It actually should have this broader demonstration. So, in fact, trying to get people who are able to show it in these very, very different contexts is precisely the mission of we're about right now.
Hi, I'm Casey. I'm actually a student in Kate Gale's class. Given that it's a culture, and that's really what's necessary to make this successful, Culture seems to be the most challenging part of changing schools. And so I'm wondering what kinds of administrative support, what kinds of training are necessary to give to teachers in order to make them successful? And is this something that is scalable?
The most successful things that we've done so far are actually creating positions with schools that are teacher researcher positions, so that people from within the schools are also researchers. And that doesn't speak to the scalability, but what it does say that is if they can get deeply involved in the research activities that allow you to see what progress is being made, and then they can also work within the classroom. It has been possible with a principal who's receptive. Once they have the safety of the test scores are not going down and something else pretty dramatic and what feels good is happening, then you get a kind of safety on that. So. But those are very rare, like when you're going to get a principal and a whole school. So the kids move from grade to grade. It gets stronger and stronger and stronger as things go on. As far as professional development, I've really started to move to, like one of the things that happens at our university is you do the professional development, but then it's kind of like, but this isn't the real world. The real world is that other world. And so you go into it, you're alone. You not only are alone, but it's not the culture of that. You don't have the technology, so there's only so much you can do with post-its. So you get this kind of the other energy just sweeps you away. You can't maintain it, and so I think that that's what's very hard about thinking in terms of professional development. I guess the thought right now is that what we need is enough varied and powerful demonstrations and ways to get the places that people are going into to actually themselves be receptive. I'm not worried about the scalability of anything. I think what I'm worried about is the ship's headed in the other direction. It's not growing it when you have a receptive environment. That's pretty easy. I mean, it takes teachers not very long. You're teaching something. You've been teaching it for 30 years, and all of a sudden you find a space where kids' ideas come forth. So anybody who's interested in kids' thinking sees a view of what they're thinking is, oh my God, I've been teaching for 30 years. I didn't know how they were conceiving of molecules. I never had these pictures before. I never even knew they could talk at this level. So that has it has an ease. You can also get the energy out of, if you have these profiles, you have all of the kids writing. You could save thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars of assessment. You have all their writing.
See, I think that, in a sense, this is more of a political and cognitive problem than it is a teacher professional problem.
That's interesting.
It is political in the sense that certain messages go out in a society at a certain time about what education is about, and we don't have to go into detail because it's pretty clear what it is. It's not just the current administration in this country, but the last several. But it's also cognitive in the sense that many of our leaders, and particularly our political leaders, don't have any sense of, I'm going to put it sort of sharply, that learning could be any different than the 5-year-old mind thinks it is. Maybe somebody knowing law in front of the room and shoving it down and being punitive. And, even if someone like Bill Clinton, to choose, probably our most capable politician, even if he understood that intuitively, he would never talk about it publicly because he would get shot right down. And I don't think that his predecessor or his successor have the intuitive understanding, so it's moot. But I think in this country, I meant it as an objective statement, not as attempted humor. I think in this country it would only be upscale independent schools and the occasional charter school that could afford to embrace these ideas, because they're very radical. They're, as you said, they're much more radical than Bransford or Brown Campione, and I think we should maybe talk a bit about that.
I find that interesting. I've only come to this very lately because I've really struggled with why couldn't we get it together, and then I realized it's working on a fundamentally different energy is why we couldn't get it together. But I want to say, Louisville, Kentucky, this is kind of amazing. The superintendent of schools saw this, said, if kids can think like that, then I will put my entire, I don't actually even care if I go down as superintendent. I believe in this. I'm going to do it. He hired a technology director who likewise just said, if we can do it, we're going to do it. It's been pretty amazing to us. They have managed between them to get 26 schools up and running in Louisville, Kentucky. They have very severe, mandates about the levels of performance. But if you think about this, I mean, there's one easy take that we have. Kids are reading and writing constantly. I mean, they're reading each other's ideas. They're curious. Even if they don't know how to read, they scribble something and somebody says, oh, what's that? And they spend 5 minutes saying, oh, that's my friend. Oh, so they work together to get my friend, and then they, oh, I can search by the word friend. So two words, you know. But this collective effort to get their ideas presented and to work on it. So a lot of reading and writing. So we just get increases in reading and writing. It's a byproduct. It's really easy. You get little kids in these schools doing things. So we have, I guess that's why I've turned to this idea, and the reason for the Institute, and as I say, the reason for being here, the reason for talking to you people is trying to find where are the people in society who actually could have a voice, and if we have some of these demonstrations, and especially like in Louisville, Kentucky, if we have demonstrations where you don't see this happening very much, maybe, just maybe, it's possible to open something
up. Yeah, Kate has a question, but on the Louisville point, if I'm not mistaken, the Louisville superintendent is the longest lived superintendent in American big cities. I think he's been there for like 8 or 10 years.
Yeah.
And that's important because the average superintendency for big cities is about 2 years in this country. Mm-hmm. And people there have no credibility. At least he's been around for a while. Maybe he's built up some political goodwill. The problem is when he goes, the next person might say, out of here.
Because
this is not a profession in this country.
Right.
It's a political thing.
But I do want to say that it was 8 years ago he started.
Oh.
So he started, but he also is a risk taker. I mean, he's really a risk taker. I believe in it. He actually never doubted that he would get the results. You see, he wasn't scared, and he just looked at what kids could do. I have to say, the National Academy of Education this year was so exciting for me because here was the National Academy of Education, and we brought little kids in from inner city schools, 80 languages, decades and decades within this school of performing below average. I mean, just, you know, the kind of school where you say impossible. I actually, if we have time, I brought a little video of a kid explaining what he's doing from what the kids presented at the National Academy. And I think it's maybe these look that, wait a second, these are below average kids who can't speak very well and are doing very bad on their language tests. I don't know. I'm encouraged by the possibility of demonstration.
I just want to add on to Howard's interest in schooling and the question about scalability in teachers is that we've also been working with the Knowledge Society Network, which is a knowledge forum-based environment for teachers. So just as kids build knowledge about their subject matters that they're engaging in inquiry around, the teachers also problematize the idea of creating a knowledge-building culture in the classroom and come together and build knowledge as a community of teachers and logging in from all over the world, depending on, you know, because it's independent of where you are, in this environment and sharing ideas in a communal space about teaching. And so that has a very important role to play in scaling up, in professional development, in building a model of community so that teachers know what it means, the power of building ideas as a teacher in their own field translates also into how to build that culture in the classroom. So this multiple layers is just critical throughout
the culture building that goes on.
That's a better answer to your question than my answer. I think getting it into the culture at all levels is much more critical.
Steve? I think there is a 180-degree shift. What impresses me most about your and Ryder's work is they seem to be getting in there and really defining what gets constructed in a way that you necessarily seen before. That, I mean, within the, you know, what, have we not defined that, there's still a way that you can think of constructivism as, you know, putting facts together, you know, and it's not that much different from the transmission or the bulk theory of knowledge. But for like within, I had the same problems in the open course of my Open Knowledge Forum and was worried about, you know, the transmission of false knowledge. And I think maybe I'm just too embedded in the knowledge, in the transmission model. But what kids actually seem to be doing is, what's getting constructed is this idea of the relationships among ideas and how ideas, you know, how ideas work together and how categories work and how to build things. And that's, so I'm just wondering if maybe the definition of what, you know, I guess it seems like you would start to see the benefits of that after a year or two of that kind of learning, that, you know, that, you know, understanding the relationships among ideas, you know, that would pay off right away.
We had a really interesting meeting this morning with John. I don't know if he's here, but he's doing studying the database where, in fact, looking at the moves around the ideas, you know, like where they went and then how the problem field shifted. He's just started to look at that database. So we were kind of wondering if you could understand the complexity of the maneuvers they were capable of doing around ideas, and you can watch the problem field develop. I have to say one of my own biggest worries is that it settles lower than it needs to settle. I don't think it settles lower than other classrooms settle. But, you know, I think it's actually also very exciting, and I'm very interested in, so when John goes in there and you have somebody who actually knows the discipline, and then you kind of wonder, well, when does X idea come in? Whatever, if you're an expert in the domain, then you can see the field of discourse. You can, I mean, it takes a millisecond with the analytic tools to see the growth of vocabulary. So you can say, wait a second, they're not talking about important concepts that they should be talking about. Well, we haven't done enough work yet, and it's what I think of as our cutting edge right now in terms of new developments, is that there's nothing to keep us from getting those concepts in, either by virtual visitors, by other people who know more about the domain, but also semantic tools are getting very, very sophisticated now. I mean, you can lay out the semantics of fields of discourse. So here's what, you know, biologists who are really good at the domain think, here's what people, you can get corpuses. So what I think one of the next kinds of things we will do is take those fields, like we'll understand more about the maneuvers, hopefully we'll get closer to that, but then you can also see the semantics of the field grow, but then we'll be able to do these semantic searches and show here's the semantic field beyond where you are. I don't think these kids think of that, I mean, that is fun. It's like, oh my God, I've never talked about this before. I think when the ship's around 180 degrees, it's not like, oh, I failed, I didn't get there. It's just like, oh, that gives me an idea of where to go next. I think that we can do a lot better, and I think actually one of the reasons it feels to me that the technology is so important is you're talking about tens and tens, hundreds of thousands of notes, people's ideas. I mean, you know, if you talk to John Seely Brown, I mean, essentially it is the social life of information. I mean, it's just a mirror of what that would look like. And so trying to figure out how to do justice to it conceptually is important.
As I look at some of this stuff, I think about knowledge transformation and sort of constructivist ideas of knowledge transformation. But somewhere in here, it also seems like deconstruction is an important part of it somehow, that there's something in there about people having a chance to say, this is what I think, and sort of taking apart what they think
into these component parts so they can put them together in a different way with other people's ideas. I mean, how does that work within it?
I think you're onto something truly important. It works in part because there's time, and I think that there's not... It's an exciting thing when it happens. For the most part, I think that it amazes me that it has taken our science so many years, that is educational science, to discover misconceptions. I mean, you know, it was only like 20, 30 years ago that the misconceptions literature really became pronounced. These kids can tell you what their misconceptions are in no time at all. What they've learned, it's got to be, is to hide those. Like they've gone underground because schooling isn't about saying, oh, guess what, I don't know. I think they just realized
that. This is the article that you assigned for us, right, about belief versus understanding.
Yeah. No, you assigned it. The reason I've been so crazy to get a hold of it is I was wondering if they were onto the same idea. But I think kids have sensors on whether they're to let out what they don't understand or whether that's important. I think what happens, part of why, again, I say it's a culture, part of when you are able to say, I need to understand, or, you know, I just don't get it, or this idea of germs just does not fit with my sense of germs, you know, like it just, that's all your note is. It's nothing other than this deconstruction angst about, wait, my ideas aren't fitting together. But, you know, if you have a teacher who says, ah, now that's an important moment, then you just learn that that's really part of what it's about.
Being so media savvy myself, I have a sense that this might be a good time for you to show something. You said this is the same kids who were at the National Academy of Education, because I heard that was a stunning experience of people who were there. And then afterwards, I want to ask you about two things. One is, if you could recreate for us the kinds of conversations that you had, particularly your group with Anne Brown's group. People who don't know about Anne Brown's group, but she was a very important thinker who died a couple of years ago, actually taught here for a brief period of time. And also, since this is a course in cognitive development, education in the brain, if you could talk a bit about how you see the relationship, I don't know if you have anything to say about the brain, except as something for people to study, and build maps of. But if you could talk a bit about the relationship between sort of classical cognitive development, a la the Journal of Cognitive Development, and what those people who are involved in education, as your school is, you know, how you think about that, I think those would be very, very unique contributions for us and for the video. Would you want to give us a change of...
Well, what I was going to just show you, it's hard to recreate the moments at this, so... I'm not sure this does a super good job, but what we did was ask the students, instead of us to present knowledge building, we asked the students to present knowledge building. So I don't have all of the, I mean, there's a lot that I don't have here, but what I'll show you is what I think people when they had the image and the teacher presented about 80 different languages in the school, the demographics are such that we have they have students decades and decades of just they've never been able to get test scores up. So these students were doing a presentation, and so I hope you'll get a little bit of a feel of the kinds of demonstrations that they were able to do. So somebody asked them. They had their database there, so it was in the background. And somebody asked them what they were studying and what they had learned. And the child said, well, we were learning about maggots, and here's his story.
It all started when Roxana found a dead pigeon on her way to the pet store. She brought the pigeon outside. She brought the pigeon into her classroom and put it outside our balcony so we could observe and see what was happening inside the pigeon. We observed it every day for a week and started to notice little maggots growing inside the pigeon. Then we started to research about the maggots. Here's a poster that shows the maggot life cycle. It goes from egg to larvae to pupa and then to fly. During our research, one big problem developed. We did not know which end was the head, the thin part or the fat part. We discussed this problem a lot inside the database and outside the database until Shakil went to the internet and found a solution. Right, the thin part was the head. This was also my theory. Here is Shakil's note. Give you some time to read it.
So look at the amount of text they have.
Did you see the age of the kid?
We wrote a lot of notes and created a lot of views in our maggot view. And this is our maggot view. As you can see, we have six views in our maggot view. Maggot existence, maggot habitats, maggot diet, maggot birth, maggot parts, and maggot life cycle.
And then this next little one jumps to when they're using the rise above node. So it's the same child, just at a different point of talking about this.
And another question. Why do flies lay eggs on dead animals? Gavin and Lucas included information of other students' notes into the rise above about why maggots why flies lay eggs on dead animals. Here is the rise above.
Anyhow, that's all there is to it. So that might not seem very dramatic to you in this embedded context, but I think what was impressive is that these students could get up. They then fielded questions about what they were doing. The technology wasn't center front. It was just the place that held their ideas, and they could talk very fluently about what others are doing. Anyhow, I don't know if you have any questions or...
Why don't we hold that question and see if there are any questions about what we just saw? Like, how old were these kids?
Third, fourth grade.
Wow.
Question. He just spoke with such poise, such confidence.
That was the thing I think that came to everybody about where did that presence come from. It came as a surprise to us, too.
Well, I think the choice of language. I mean, this is meta-theoretical language. Hypothesis, theory, research. Unless somebody was whispering it in his ear, this is the way he actually talks, which I think would blow most people's minds. Mary?
How did you or your kids define the theory? What they were saying, what the theory is?
Okay. That's a fun question. You know, we spent, I always embarrassed because it just suggests how slow I am. I think 5 years, maybe 3 years, I don't know, it feels like a long time now. We were trying to get students to express what they needed to understand, their confusions, like tap into, instead of always trying to do the knowledge telling, to do those ideas that would open up the knowledge transformation. So we talked about your idea, your guess, your hypothesis. We used every word but theory. Theory is what we wanted, but we figured they wouldn't know what a theory was, so we couldn't use the word theory. 1 year, it's kind of like, oh, darn, let's just use the word theory. Well, you know, they have this vague sense that that's something like my idea, and we never said a word. It's just one of the scaffolds in here. So if you look at the environment, I'll see if I can take you back to a picture of this just so you see it. They just put this, my theory, you just touch the word, the scaffold, my theory, and it jumps into their writing space. So my theory is. So it's just a very way to bring an idea into their discourse. Then I think when somebody says, oh, but my theory is different, you see a growth in their understanding of the concept of theory. So I think it's really just my idea, what I think. It really isn't a theory. But as time goes by, they get more and more elaborate work around that. And then I think that you will get a sense that they really are putting forth theories, and they really.
I think what's interesting, if I were to see this cold, I would speculate that either this kid is a really gifted kid, prodigious, or the kid comes from an academic household. Because in academic households, you learn to talk that way. And there's a great story about Herbert Eve Clarke, whom you probably know, psycholinguist at Stanford. And their four-year-old son, whose name was Adam or something like that, found it was very difficult to get his parents' attention at the breakfast table. So finally he said one day, well, I read this interesting article this morning. And as an event for them, and I think that's what we're seeing here is basically the kind of language which you would expect in a certain kind of household for a kid who is quite advanced has become part of the culture of that particular class. We'll get to Louisville in a minute, but are there other questions about what we just saw? A bunch of them, yeah. Oh, Damon, thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, good question. We certainly the notion of creating a culture that really respects other people's ideas. Like in grade one, one of the things the teacher, Kate, I know whether you work with Rosemary, but anyhow, the teacher would always sit there and say, so what are the kinds of things when you're talking and somebody says something to you, it just makes you feel like, I'm not going to say anymore. And then the kids would say, well, what are the kinds of things? Like if somebody says, oh, well, that's stupid, or, well, why do you think that? Or if they make you feel dumb about your ideas. And then, well, what are the things that you say to each other that make you feel good? So just sitting in a group talking about what makes you want to go on with your ideas and what doesn't. And so this is like grade one, right away into an appreciation of other people's ideas. The other is just simply that's not what this medium is for. And so, like I know one teacher would just say, I just don't expect to see that kind of talk in there. And so if any of you start seeing it, it would be good if you could write a note to somebody and remind them that that's not what this is about. So you'll just see the students say, well, wait a second. First of all, it's not a dumb idea. The person's just working on this. And if you think it's dumb, then why don't you try to say something better than that? Or you will just see the kids tackling this as it's just not what's expected. So I think in some sense, because we were working with teachers who would create this kind of culture of respect for people's idea and working together, I guess, thought it would go on, but I can give you two counterexamples that really opened our eyes about additional problems we faced. The one was in Toronto, there's a place where, you know, it's a real high-end school where it is so competitive. I mean, it's like, you know, you've got to get A-pluses in that school if you stand a chance to go on to prize professions. It was the first time we saw the database where it was so unkind. It was actually, we wanted to get out of there so fast. I mean, it felt like there was nothing you could do about it than just shut this space down. And then all of a sudden, we were contemplating, what in the world do we do about this? And then there was one person in this database who said, well, wait a second, you're saying this is dumb, but it made me think of something really new, and it also linked up. And one person started to manage to be very kind, but also to link things up in important ways. She didn't totally turn the database around, but she really made a difference in the level of discourse. And she graduated from one of the schools we had worked in long before. So she had been very used to something different, and she was actually able to do this. And interestingly, it's more the females, I must say, than the males, if you look at the data, who do this wide reading of the database and see part of their job as creating links. I myself look at, there are these analytics tools that can tell you, are people's ideas getting any energy around them? So if I'm teaching with this, I will find, the people, nobody's commenting on their ideas, nobody's reading their ideas. You can become a real social isolate. And I will typically just say, that's a really interesting idea, and I'll link it to some other people's ideas. And so it doesn't take long to shift things around if you know what you're doing. But that was a really negative example. And the other one was, interestingly, in Singapore, where instead of the reflective time, instead of any of the deconstruction time, they had this sense that you just go fast, and they just pounded this thing, you know? It was like every note was written in less than a minute, and it was out there. And this note, like there was no building on top of other people's notes. And there was this sense, but wait a second, if I put any of my good ideas out there, somebody else will get it, and they'll get the good grade. So why would I do that? It's just not what we do. So we certainly have entered context where, you know, it's really antagonistic to what business they're set to be doing. I have to say that Singapore was interesting, though, because I was suggesting that maybe these kids who believe that competition is what it's all about should read some things about the new economy and what knowledge sharing is all about and why knowledge sharing is so important for the new economy. So I think you can always kind of get in there and suggest that this isn't the way the culture must be. There are other kinds of forces, but it's always a design problem.
Why don't we just take Ryan's question and then go back to the Louisville question. You want to sit down?
Yeah, and somebody, I wanted to actually show you one thing before I sat down, if you don't mind. I wanted to show you, if you look really quickly here, when these notes were being shown. I just jumped forward. See those little yellow things? That's what they can customize. So if you get the discourse of, I need to understand my theory, my improved theory, you just touch those and they jump into this. And so I think that that's what embeds the discourse into these kind of metacognitive, more reflective acts. The other thing I just wanted to show you, the other thing the audience did, and I think was part of what was very interesting, is then ask them as a panel how they felt about this. And I just found this one last night, and I enjoyed it because it takes us back to the writing. I hope I have the right one. They were just asking, well, what's the effect of this on your writing? And I'll just jump up here. So here's a girl trying to explain the effect of working in this environment on her writing. I just wanted to show you. I just found that last.
I really would like to thank all of you immensely for
the time and energy. Okay, we have a queue. Ryan, Jonathan, and then whoever it was who had the Louisville question, which we have on a stack. Yeah.
I was wondering if there are other creative ways to accomplish the same goals without the use of technology, which would give answers to those schools or districts that don't have the resources?
Actually, a big part of the project that Ann Brown and I set about was to do one with the technology, one without. Hers was going to be without. They would use a writing environment where students wrote various chapters of a book from the studies that they were doing, but they didn't have the technology that would allow this kind of continual improvement and recording of their ideas. It turned out, though, that it turns out to everything so much easier with the technology. I mean, it's a little bit scary once you're accustomed to it, but students' portfolios just sit in here. They just have to create another view, and you get their portfolio. And so I haven't shown you any of the views. You get a historical account of their ideas over many years so that it just allows them to actually do searches by their ideas and put them out. So there definitely are. We do a lot of post-its. The technology director in Louisville actually will never ever let the teachers touch the technology for the first day of understanding about this, because he keeps saying it's not about technology, and they use post-its and they use strings, and we have teachers in New Hampshire. We have many people who have done that. The trouble is, it isn't that, I don't think, is very scalable for the life of ideas. You know, it's just really hard to let the ideas escape from the classroom. I mean, there's a lot of power that comes when you do a search and you find your idea out there in a discourse with somebody in another part of the world, and you're starting to read what they're doing. That helps a lot. Being able to keep portfolios. So I think it's possible. I mean, obviously, I think people have done this for millennia. If we're doing anything right, it's because we're mirroring the real history of thought, and if we're doing it wrong, it's because we're getting that wrong. So it's obviously been done for centuries, and cultures have always done it. I think that bringing new technologies to it might just make it more less an elitist phenomenon and more possible for more people to be engaged in the process.
You mentioned that the history of ideas suggests that ideas gradually improve. And you also mentioned that some of these databases, you know, with certain ideas have no energy around them, so people are not picking them up. And this reminded me a little bit of meme theory, the idea that certain ideas are inherently more popular. And the idea there, as I understand it, is not so much that the right ideas are kind of more successful, it's those that are more adaptive to the culture. And that troubled me, because we like to think that ideas are in some way tracking the truth. But if you take meme theory seriously, all you're really tracking is popular currents of thought and cultural priorities. Are you concerned about that at all? Because it seems to me that this might lead in that direction.
Yeah, but if you also look at meme theory, you know, it's not so easy to get a popular idea. It's not even so easy to get an idea to have a very long life. And even though it is about pop culture, if you look at what ideas survive in society, they tend to have some usefulness for some group, for some, you know, they do some real work in society, or they just don't tend to make it. So yeah, there's the popular idea, but again, if you have, like, one of the reasons we keep trying to distinguish this from communities of practice writ large is every practicing community is a community of practice. I mean, Al-Qaeda is a community of practice. Well, you've got to have a community for knowledge advancement. And if the culture is about the advancement of those ideas, then somebody's going to say, yeah, well, okay, that's a popular idea, but what about this whole group of people who don't agree? If an idea really has to work in society, then, you know, you have different groups with different ideas. You're going to buy into that. I mean, you're going to have to buy into that energy.
I certainly accept that the popular ideas are those that are more adaptive or useful, but my concern is that in evolutionary theory, physically we don't necessarily improve, we just become more adaptive to whatever environmental needs we have. In the same way, ideas don't necessarily improve as such. They don't necessarily advance in the way you say. It might be just that they somehow are more adaptive.
I think you have to make a distinction between science and maybe math on the one hand and everything else. Because I think science is based on the predication that, by and large, the newer ideas are more comprehensive and do a better job of predicting and explaining the world. I don't think anybody would claim that about art. When you get into something like social science, I think it's a very mixed picture.
I've always wondered what you think of Wilson's consilience. Do you know his book on consilience? Yeah. The one thing that keeps attracting me about this, and we don't have the data to really show this, but it's kind of this notion that, you know, I keep wanting to say to people, if you're going deep into a discipline and the forces that be are taking you deeper into it, like, what is the fear? Like, where are you going to go that could be so bad? And this notion that if you're deep into the discipline, you're going to find the interconnectedness between disciplines. And so that, in a sense, it's almost anti-popular in that you're not staying shallow if you're going deep. I'm kind of curious what you think of both consilience and this notion that there's nothing so wrong that can go so wrong if you have a culture hooked on understanding.
Well, two issues, but remember, you're being interviewed. I think Consilience is a great book to talk about, and if I were running a faculty seminar, I think it would be a first choice. I guess basically I'm not in sympathy with what I think Wilson is really trying to do. What Wilson says he's trying to do is to find connections among thought. Who could be opposed to that? But I think what he really wants, I think what he really is a reductionist.
Oh.
And I really think he doesn't really understand art and history at all if he thinks that we're ever going to be able to, what I've said, and I've said this publicly, is that, what sociobiology has to say about history and art is either trivial or wrong. If I think where I think he's trying to go, I'm completely opposed to it. But like every great polemicist, there's a soft Wilson and a hard Wilson. And of course, if you were here, and I interviewed him, you can see the tape here a couple of years ago, on the consilience, he would say, well, of course, you know, art has to be seen in its own terms and blah, blah, blah. He knows the right kind of moves, but I don't think that's what he really thinks.
You can't stay shallow if you get people who are just going to give a different perspective.
Make this concrete, and I have this from Alan Wolf. Alan Wolf said in the 1960s, everything changed. Women's movement, civil rights, Vietnam War, sexual liberation, blah, blah, blah. You could know everything about sociobiology. It would not at all enable you to predict that. That's a historical, cultural event. And what's interesting about Matisse and Picasso, who you can see together now at the Museum of Modern Art, can never be explained by sociobiology. It's a wrong way to go. They can say, yeah, we look at bright colors rather than dull colors. Do we need sociobiology to tell us that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now the other question was, can understanding go wrong? Yeah, it can. I think understanding is different from morality and ethics. You mentioned Al-Qaeda. Hitler had a quite active science group, and as long as they stayed in certain ways, he wanted the right answer. Yeah, no, I think you need a separate ethical compass.
Thanks. I've been saying this, and what you're saying is so obviously correct that clearly I have to rethink what it is that I do want to say, because I do think that when you were asking about when it goes wrong, there is almost a morality of how you treat ideas and what you do, and that is different from the understanding issue. I think what I've gotten, grew up so much at the time, even 10, 20 years ago, there was so much a sense that our biggest educational problems were that kids had inert knowledge, they didn't think deeply, they don't want to think deeply, that the expert novice literature all kept laying it out, like the novice has shallow understanding. They, if they're trying to understand anything about a content area, it's because they simply get really easy answer, and they stick with that answer, and so those are the answers that come out. So it was, I think I went through that period of time thinking, the problem is inert knowledge, kids don't like to think deeply, that is the problem of education. I think we were all posed with that problem, and I think now I'm thinking, boy, that isn't the problem at all. I think these kids really like to think. They convey an enjoyment that, I don't have the videos for that either, but these students like to do this. They remember ideas from 3 years ago. They're still thinking about them. They can tell you the history of where they've gone.
But typically, it doesn't happen in school, typically.
It happens
with kids arguing with their parents, where they are like lawyers. It happens with things they're fans about. It typically doesn't happen with understanding the maggots. Now, there was a question left over from Louisville, which we...
Right.
I was just wondering if you could cite any key, either circumstances with the superintendent or maybe the technology director or just the district as a whole that really led to the success there, because I would tend to agree with, you know, maybe Howard, that in some urban districts this would be hard to implement with such success.
Yeah. I think that, first of all, the superintendent was behind it, but he didn't do any of the getting it out into Louisville. The person who did was Alan Whitworth, who was his superintendent of technology. And so what they did was they were going to put technology in schools. They have budgets for getting the technology into the schools. They would interview teachers about the extent to which, his line was, are you ready for knowledge building? Like, if not, don't do it. What I really want, if I'm going to put this level of investment in your classroom, because we need, well, like if you just have one or two computers, you just don't have the students having enough time to get enough of their ideas to build up any energy, and they get so little time to do it. So in order to get an installation that would really support a community that could work easily, they needed to invest quite a few thousands of dollars in the classroom. So the teachers could apply to do it, but if they didn't feel like they could do it, they were really encouraged not to apply. But furthermore, he said, and if you're there, but I actually am not finding work going on, I will remove the technology. Like, you can have the technology at whatever level you need it. So if, in fact, you're using it, he would find that most computers in all classrooms, this had nothing to do with knowledge form, but they're only used for such a tiny fraction of the day in schools, because schools really aren't that much mobilized that you need access to the technology very much at all. So you put a lot of money into computers and they're really only used for minor portions of the time. So he was saying, you know, if that's what you're doing, then only ask me for the level of technology you want. If you want entire communities engaged in building knowledge, then I will look at your profiles of whether you're doing it or not. So you need to be ready for this. And so he got teachers who were ready, and then I think out of that they had local people who were becoming very inventive. I think that's the other thing we haven't talked about. It takes a kind of invention about how you're going to get communities talking in these ways that actually allow their ideas to grow and how you're going to organize. So then I think that just a couple the first year started creating a kind of excitement, but now it wasn't coming from a distant source. It was really the teachers being very inventive. And then when it didn't work, he really did move the technology to some place that needed it. It was considered to be a prize. Oh, I mean, it's an expensive investment in a school, and it's like if you don't need that investment. So they interview teachers. They hold workshops continuously, like every year. They come to workshops. They come to our Summer Institute every year. We're expecting we're going to be on some new path and doing something new constantly. So they invest the monies in doing that. Now, interestingly, they're getting better results they're investing money in a lot of other kinds of activities, so this is not a more expensive activity. It's just a judicious use of it in a way that takes those people committed to doing it and brings them together. So,
I want to get my two other questions in, and people should be thinking whether you have some final questions. We're working you very hard, and we appreciate it.
I love it. It's fun.
This is very precious. Your group and Ann Brown's group really did try to work together, and there aren't any people that I know of in the world who thought more about the relationship between our understanding of the developing mind on the one hand and how to do practice in school that we can feel good about. Both it's based on our understanding and it's got some demonstrable effects, and both FCL and Cecil did have demonstrable effects. Can you recreate for us the nature of the discussion which you alluded to when you said that, you know, when you really got down to it, there was some real deep, I think you used the word epistemological tensions, because I think that would really be valuable for us to try to understand.
Well, I think the deep tension was that if you look at the structure of the fostering communities of learners, what you have is different groups that were scheduled to rotate. So different groups would get good at something, whatever the content was, that they would divide into groups, and then you would develop an expertise. And then you would have distributed expertise in what was the jigsaw, so that the kids would rotate, so that they had this kind of sense of being accomplished, having ideas that somebody else needed. And but of course embedded in that was also a rotation that was a physical act, like you needed to move, you'd have a 45 minute period of time. So it was structured to fit into the school curriculum and the 45 minute rotations. They would also have the benchmark lessons, so that they would bring in people who were expert in the particular domain, and they would look very carefully at the curriculum of the domain, and you know what it would take to actually be able to move from a kind of grade 2 level of understanding to a grade 3, grade 4. They would talk about corridors. So they had the curricular expertise in people who were working. They had the jigsaw working. They had the benchmark lesson, which was a very clear part about this. And they had what they called crosstalk. So the moments when they had live conversations were the moments when one group could talk across any of the three groups. They didn't have to just rotate around that structure of the defined expertises. So that worked so much as a system.
And each of those things, by the way, had a shadow growing out of developmental theory.
Absolutely.
Some of which they themselves had created.
Yeah.
That's really important. They developed a curricular package which drew upon and synthesized, you know, Vygotsky and Brown and Elliot Aronson and stuff like that.
Yeah. No, I think that's really important, because each of them was embedding both a long developmental history, but also a translation into education that actually made it fit within classrooms as they run. Like, they would actually be reconstructing the classroom in interesting ways across the years, but it really fit with those structures. And they became activity structures that people could understand. Like, they could understand the jigsaw, they could understand the benchmark lesson, they could understand crosstalk. They were live things. You could look and say, I could do a crosstalk. I can do a jigsaw. I understand that. So they had a disseminable quality. So you put a knowledge forum in, as we did. I think it was still called CECL at that time. But well, now there's not so much reason to do these rotations, because anybody can read anybody's ideas at any time and are already building on the ideas. So then if you have the rotation, it's kind of like, well, wait, I've already visited those ideas, or I've already done that. And then the benchmark lesson would come at a certain point, whereas the teachers who were, the kids' ideas were growing, they were coming to something, and then you're saying, wait, they're on a breakthrough here. We don't want this standard benchmark lesson that is going to move them all here when their discourse is headed off here. So it was really, it was this different energy of a more opportunistic ideas growing in a way that almost went counter to these activity structures. For Anne, I think the thing that was always was that she used to talk about lethal mutations all of the time. Like, it was no matter what you tried to do and define, the jigsaw, the crosstalk, the reciprocal teaching, you would embed these deep theories into these structures. But then people would take them at the most shallow of levels. So it was these kind of lethal mutations. I think the one thing was that the respect, the reason it was so easy for us to talk about this, is the last thing we wanted was lethal mutations on either of each other's ideas. And so we were really very respecting the fact that the teachers themselves, unless they took them to the shallow level, where they were just activity structures, couldn't get the deep-seated structure of them. And as I say, I think Anne really, I think this guided discovery versus knowledge creation, like that's what I've come to, is the real thing that was our deep, deep, deep difference in how we were proceeding.
Now, I'm very confident she understood what you were trying to do. What was her attitude? Was that, well, maybe for some kids that's okay, or maybe that's okay for high school or college? I mean, I'm sure she wasn't dismissive of it, but why, in a sense, did she not want to buy into it?
I don't, you know, it's actually, and it makes me sad constantly that she's not here to talk about that. We didn't ever talk about it in those terms, because I don't think either of us understood it in those terms, and I'm not even sure she'd buy into what I'm saying. And she might well not. I know that she actually would have said that hers is about knowledge creation, and that these students, I don't think she would buy the different language I'm using, and I think perhaps I don't have a language good enough to talk about it, and I don't know what she would say, honestly. This notion of not having the guiding force, certainly the Vygotsky, the Bruner guided discovery really is the key piece out there in our field that says what education is about. And we almost have to go to learning organizations literature, to meme theory, to the evolution of thought. It's almost like we're, and when you say about cognition too, I've been wondering, do we need a science of knowledge building? That is, it's not clear to me. We have a science about how knowledge, new knowledge, how do new ideas get into the world? And in a sense, there are never any new ideas, but you can certainly identify points in time when new ideas do enter our discourse and new ideas are there. And so my real thing about cognitive science, like the reason I'd love to talk to Anne is, I'd love to hear the way she tells the story. It could be very different. I just don't know.
Since you mentioned Bruner, and then we'll go to back to the class, I mean, if there's anybody in the world who would kind of understand both things pretty well, it would be he. I mean, have you talked with him about you know, the relationship between these endeavors?
No. I have certainly gone back and subsequently read again what Anne has written about guided discovery, and the notion that that's very much based on Bruner's idea of guided discovery. And of course, you can imagine how, I mean, you know, this notion that students should be able to generate new ideas. And the one thing we keep saying, which I think this is what Anne had the most trouble with. We're not trying to say that these young students are putting out ideas that are genuinely new to the world, but they are putting ideas forward that are new to their community. And they are meeting ideas of people who are talking about new ideas in the field. So they have a culture of the generation of new ideas, and they're on a trajectory to be able to work innovatively with ideas. I think our biggest tension would be we don't systematically have the benchmark lessons. We're looking for much more opportunistic, self-organizing systems around how knowledge advances. And I think hers was a very clearly defined set of activity structures.
They really are, in Kuhnian terms, very different paradigms. And both of them are at odds with a dominant educational paradigm in this country. But I think you're absolutely right in implying that Anne's would be easier for people in education to swallow than yours, which really has, it's got more of a root in the disciplines you mentioned. Yeah.
I'm assuming that going into other countries and testing this out has a great cost assignment to it. I mean, I don't know, I saw you yesterday in Kaiming's class. I don't know if you've gotten to Hong Kong or China. But I'm wondering what, I have several reasons why I think that's justified, and I think you can learn a lot from doing cross-cultural studies, but I'm wondering what your theory is on that, and what's the reasoning behind it.
Well, I have to, the reason behind it is really that it's got to finally be cross cultural cross age, like if we're hitting something deep about the evolution of thought, it should be a proof of concept. The other thing is that I think that North America is really so obsessed with packaging up everything that trying to get a chance for how might knowledge develop if you didn't package everything up, it's like real hard to study here. It's much more interesting where you have a couple of societies that are at the top of the assessment heap and are trying to figure out, you know, how do we become more creative? How do we become more problem solvers? So you kind of have an energy there that is they're just on a different sense of the both the time frame within which they want to work and less of an obsession of doing well on the test because they do well on the test. So the truth of the matter is it's actually less expensive. And the reason it's less expensive, and this is, again, this is part of this kind of dream, even this creation of an Institute for Knowledge, Innovation, and Technology, it's really just trying to say there are some people out there who are genuinely worried and concerned about education and in position or wanting to take risks. They really believe that something else is needed. And so it's kind of, you know, and a lot of those people are in ministries elsewhere, and there are just people out there who are really worried about education. So getting people together to contemplate alternatives seems actually to be the fun part of this. And I think that trying to get demonstrations like in Hong Kong, in Singapore, there are just groups that are trying to sort out the very same activities we're doing. And so once you know, we can now, just as this child was showing this, and he was showing you his database, well, now you can just virtually visit these classrooms. They can tell you what they're doing, and they can show you your database. You can play a movie of a database. So you can start to see the assessment tools that show you the growth of vocabulary of every child in the database. We think we'll be able to show you the semantic fields. We actually even believe we'll be able to take biologists, and we'll be able to say, here's biology discourse about these fields. Here's these kids' discourse mapping onto that. So we think that we'll be able to show these demonstrations, and there are lots of people out there who just believe education has to change.
And when you're talking about linking up, I think you're saying it's the idea there, and they're saying that's going throughout the whole world. Have you thought about linking up with different hubs throughout the world instead of having...
That's exactly what we're trying to do, and as I say, I'm just repeating, I mean, the kind of thing that just the conversation we had this morning, like if we can take looks at deep disciplinary knowledge, if we can take looks at complexity, is it growing? We can take a research team that is now anywhere in the world and can look at this. We literally have embedded in these databases the evolution of thought in classrooms and in health centers. So you've got a gold mine of research. It's really kids' ideas and their growth over extended periods of time. I think it's a data source that education's never had before, and research teams that you know, no single teacher can look at what's happening in their classroom at all of these levels. But once they see them, like I can give you, these happen constantly every day now. These healthcare, they're committed to interprofessional development. They're assembled in order to do that. It's necessary for the health work that they're doing in Canada to lower the cost, get nurses more involved in, you know, more of the anyhow. Sorry, I'm saying this fast because I know time's running out, but interprofessional development and being able to get more distributed work in healthcare is their goal. When we look at their discourses, they only come to us at the beginning because they know that new technologies are important. I don't think they're barely thinking we're going to be a knowledge-building culture, but they're interested in technology. They start to see profiles of the work they're doing, and they're not talking to each other at all. But they've never seen that before. So they just see the doctors talk to the doctors, the nurses talk to the nurses, the occupational therapists. So here's a matrix of who's talking to who, and they're not doing interprofessional development. So the first time, it took us till the end of the course. We did the data and thought, oh, yeah, yeah, they you know, didn't do it. The second time we ran the course, day one, we just let them see the matrix of who's talking to who. we get interprofessional discourse so fast, it's out of sight. Interestingly, while people fear that if you read naive thoughts, you'll wallow in naive thoughts, the truth of the matter is when we show the activity centers and where they move and have a child say, oh, I used to think this, I'm going to think this, you can just watch the database move there, and then they can show the evolution of the thought. So that's what's making us think we could be, so we could speed up this process dramatically. It's a really exciting design challenge. And the international part is just, it gets a kind of energy that I have to say, I think North America is just so scared about education right now. It's more fun elsewhere. There's lots of fun here, but there's a lot of fun.
We have time for one more caller, I think.
I have a sort of quick, I think. I was thinking about the knowledge form as a software application, and I was curious, I don't know what the intellectual property sort of status of it is, but if you thought about releasing it as like an open source product and having people, even schools, customize it and change the code and submit it back so that it actually is sort of under a process of sort of idea change itself, which I think would be sort of an interesting another level.
Yeah, we have historically, so part of it is open source. The reason all of it isn't open source, I have to say embarrassingly, is the code is too kludgy. Engineers wouldn't be excited about those portions of the code. That's because I think it's also a very fascinating story. Trying to keep up with all the technological innovations and port and report to every changed environment, like browsers now, it has knocked me out how many threaded discourse, you say something, you say something, you say something, you say something. Line of discourse like this. As best we can tell, it's really not good for knowledge building. It really traps things in lines of discourse. You can't get interconnections. It dominates the web. It dominates the web. It's technologically easy, and it is in every piece of almost anything you can find. So what we find is that we get a lot of the force of the new technologies where people, if they don't deeply have the theoretical framework, they can change it, and they do, but it doesn't deepen the theory on all of those fronts. And there are, it's a huge question you're asking. That you're on to what I think is needed, but it's they're huge issues.
I think it should be obvious that we have somebody here who is both an important scientist and scholar, and at the same time is doing something in education, which I think can only become more important. The final shape it'll take, nobody knows, but I think anybody who doesn't think that knowledge building and transforming and creation and construction is what's going to be more to premium doesn't really understand both what machines can already do and what the demands are going to be in the future. You were great to come here and talk and listen. And I wanted to say, if people want to know about what you were hearing about today with foster communities of learning and knowledge forms, Sicily and so on, this is a good book. It's edited by Kate McGilley, McGilly, MIT Press, about 5, 6, 7 years ago. And the chapter actually came from this book, right? This is an interesting book, Liberal Education and Knowledge Society. I think it's really about Carl Bereiter, but it's presented as being by some guy named Karras. But there are very interesting discussions in here by people who know something about education, about what they think about KF. I don't know whether the library has this or not. We could probably put it on reserve if it.
Where'd you find that?
It was actually sent to me. It was sent to me by.
Oh, open source. Great.
Yes, David Ramsey Steele.
Great.
Okay, the editor, right? Right.
Hi, maybe you can give them your name.
Okay. Well, thanks again very much. And section.
Thank you.